Film Spotting is presented by PeerFlix. Trade DVDs online at peerflix.com/filmspotting.
What kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
Well, look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
From Chicago, by way of Wausau, Wisconsin, this is Film Spotting. I'm Adam Kempinar.
And I'm Sam Van Halgren. Coming up, we celebrate Election Week with a show devoted to war, sex, and patriotism, including reviews of The Queen from director Stephen Frears and John Cameron Mitchell's controversial Short Bus.
We'll also play Massacre Theater, talk with actor Barry Pepper, and reveal our top five sophomore efforts. But let's start, Sam, with the story behind the picture that won World War II, Flags of Our Fathers.
You get it?
I don't know. I wish I could have seen their faces.
The right picture can win or lose a war.
You're going to want to see this.
Now, this picture, people went crazy over it. The country was tired of war. One photo, almost all on its own, turned that around.
Flags of Our Fathers is the first part in Clint Eastwood's ambitious two-part story about the Battle of Iwo Jima, a battle which took place between American and Japanese troops in February and March of 1945. The second part, Letters from Iwo Jima, will be released next year and will tell the story from the Japanese perspective. Flags of Our Fathers concerns itself primarily with the capture of the highest point on the island of Iwo Jima, Mount Suribachi, and even more specifically with the people that took part in the raising of the U.S. flag atop Suribachi, an image that became the war's most iconic photograph. Adam, some people are comparing Flags of Our Fathers to Eastwood's great revisionist Western Unforgiven, which deconstructs some of the Western's great mythic figures. Of course, World War II has its own complicated mythology, and Eastwood is obviously interested in demystifying the war, and maybe war in general, particularly the concept of heroism. But before you tell me how successful you thought Eastwood was at achieving that goal, I want to talk a bit about how Eastwood handled the depiction of war. Last year, we reviewed Ron Howard's Cinderella Man, and we mentioned how Howard only reluctantly accepted the project because he wasn't sure if he'd be able to bring anything new to the genre, the boxing movie genre. And in the aftermath of films like Saving Private Ryan and The Thin Red Line and any number of other films about World War II, does Eastwood find a new way to tell the war story?
Well, it's funny because I was considering this question while I watched the movie, and I think one of the answers is the fact that, yes, there is something new, and I think part of it is what you said about what this film was about, which is about heroism. And what we get from a lot of war movies is the glorification of heroes or the creation of heroes. And this film is very much about breaking down that myth and showing these people who were celebrated as heroes as real people and really struggling with this label of heroes. So I think that's one thing we see that's different. But in terms of how it's done as a war movie, I think the answer might be that it's a war movie with only a little bit of war in it. There is an enormous battle sequence in this film that I think some people will see similarities in the way it's handled to Saving Private Ryan, certainly in the chaos of it and the goriness of it. I think people will see some similarities to that Normandy sequence of Saving Private Ryan. And we do get other war scenes sprinkled in to this film. But ultimately, this is a film, as I said, about these soldiers dealing with the effects of war, being back at home, being paraded around by the media and by the government as heroes. And I thought that really was a fascinating story. It really made me think, actually, of a movie we recently reviewed on our podcast, The Times of Harvey Milk, the documentary about Harvey Milk, where I knew little bits about Harvey Milk and the Times of Harvey Milk.
As his first openly gay
exactly.
politician.
I knew that. I knew about the Twinkie defense. I knew certain parts of the story, but really didn't know anything about the sweeping kind of angle of the story, how big, really, and important a story it was. And here, I didn't know any of this stuff. I mean, sure, I knew about the raising of the flag and how celebrated it is, but I didn't know the stuff about how it was actually the second flag that was raised. I didn't know about the fact that there were six guys and three of them died, and three were, you know, again, kind of paraded around by the government, and then cast off. And I thought that was really interesting. Unfortunately, I did have problems with this film, mainly with its structure, but I want to go ahead and see what you thought.
Yeah, I agree with you. There were a lot of really interesting facts about this movie that were truly, truly fascinating, I thought. And I loved the idea of, you know, that these people are very, very specifically dealing with the idea of being labeled as heroes and how they deal with that, and that these are ordinary men. At some mm-hmm. point later in the film, we realize, you know, among these men celebrated for raising the flag at Iwo Jima, they go back to becoming a janitor, living out their lives as a janitor or as somebody who owns a mortuary. And it's just, I was talking with my wife about this too, and she grew up in this small Wisconsin town, and her dad would always point out when one of the World War II or even World War I veterans died. I mean, how meaningful that was for that generation. And she would play taps at some of these funerals or at the Memorial Day parade or at 4th of July parades. And, of course, not really having any sense of what that means to a certain generation. And she pointed out that just that idea, these are ordinary men. And I don't think any film has maybe done as well as this has as reminding us
and ordinary
of that fact.
Boys, in fact.
Ordinary boys.
Yeah.
And it's interesting, too. I was thinking of that fact that that one of the original plans was to cast age-appropriate characters. I mean, these kids were 18, 19, 20 years old.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, they didn't really end up doing that. One character, Jamie Bell, who plays Iggy in this film, does have that strikingly young face. And when you see him sort of walk up on the shores of Iwo Jima, I was really startled, emotionally startled, by seeing such a young face.
Well, there's one other as well, and Barry Pepper will bring this up in the interview we're going to play later. Joseph Cross, who's right now starring in Running with Scissors, he is also in this film and looks incredibly young, even younger than the 19 he is.
You're right. Ultimately, though, I will say, watching the film, a lot of this very sort of interesting revisionist history, taking another look at history and another look at heroism, is interesting, but is revealed really early. And there's not a lot of new information or new perspectives that are revealed to us as the film goes on. And I ended up really not being all that compelled by the film. Again, interesting. It's very, very respectful to these people and what they accomplished. Absolutely. And it certainly wants to take, you know, offer us another look at this iconic moment in U.S. history. And in that way, it's interesting, but not as a film really compelling. And
no.
I felt it lacked a sense of immediacy in a way. And certainly the way those battle scenes are filmed, like Private Ryan, the whole idea is to create a sense of immediacy, put you there. But as far as the immediacy of knowing these characters,
right.
In some way, it was interesting. I mean, of course, you know, the U.S. government used these men as symbols of heroism to sell war bonds. I think in a way, Eastwood uses them as symbols of, you know, exploring heroism. I mean, they still don't
come alive,
non-heroism, whatever it is,
or
the complications of heroism, but they're still stock characters that are being used to a different purpose.
No, I actually completely agree with you, and it's interesting that I got to the end of the film, and you see what becomes of these three guys, especially Ira Hayes, this Native American, and it's really tragic, and I realized when I got to the end that I was never actually more interested in the characters and more moved emotionally than I was there at the end of the film, and I felt almost, you know, I was disappointed that I felt like I could have gotten so much more, you know, that I missed certain opportunities, that they missed certain opportunities to really allow me to get to understand these characters, because I never really did either. And it's funny, I wrote all three of them in my notes. I said that all three of them end up becoming kind of caricatures. They become simplified versions of who they were, and I think it's because the movie is constantly moving back and forth in time, and so you end up just getting snapshots of who they are. Ira Hayes, like I said, really fascinating character. The fact is, can you remember much about him at all except the fact that he's always drunk and crying? No, you really can't,
right.
Or at least I can't. So I thought that was unfortunate.
There's like a simpleness with which
there
the
is.
Tragedy is
it's put up there. And so, you know, the other thing, too, I'll say is that Clint Eastwood made a mistake with Mystic River, I thought, where we had this disembodied voice, Kevin Bacon's wife, actually the disembodied mouth you had, right? Just the lips talking on the telephone. It was really distracting and annoying. And here we've got the voiceless head of Tom McCarthy, who's the son of Ryan Phillippe's character. He's the guy who actually wrote
James
the book.
Bradley,
James
right?
Bradley, he wrote the book that this movie is based on. He's the son researching this story of his father and the other two men.
And we see him talking with veterans.
And except we never actually do see him talking with veterans. We actually don't see him open his mouth until the end of the film. He's always being talked to. He's never engaged in a conversation. He's always just being orated to. And that's what it feels like.
It's really unclear why.
It is. And these characters are just sort of, they are orating. I feel like they're telling a story in a way that they could be giving a lecture or something. Yeah. It's not at all, you know, organic and that they're talking. And so just as he's being just lectured to in a way, I felt that's sort of what we were getting as well. And I was never engaged in it. And I felt like the whole structure of that, I was never interested in his story.
Right.
The fact that he as a son is researching this because he gives us nothing.
It's never really introduced.
No,
he's not introduced as the son. And that's interesting. I think there was a missed opportunity there. And I have this bad habit of like, okay, I'm not engaged in this film.
Mm-hmm.
How can I fix it?
Right.
Totally moot point. But I was like, how much more immediate would this film have been if, say, he was interviewing actual World War II vets
right.
about their actual experience.
Mm-hmm.
No, he wouldn't be talking to the actual characters as they are older, you know, now in terms of where they fit into the story. But having just seen Warren Beatty's Reds not long ago, the way he integrated actual documentary interviews with people that lived through that time, an immediate sense of what it was like to be there, framing this fictional, you know, this account.
Yeah.
This filmed account. And again, I'm not saying that would have necessarily improved it, but I lacked a sense of immediacy with this film. That couldn't have hurt.
Yeah, no, I agree. I lack that connection as well. And so Eastwood does a good job with it. Obviously a very talented director, but there's something missing for both of us. And let's go ahead and move on then to another film we're going to talk about, a film that kind of has an interesting tie-in with Flags of Our Fathers, actually, and that is the movie The Queen from director Stephen Frears. And we got an email from one of our listeners, Christina, who wrote in, Sam, and said she noticed that we had a question mark by it. Were we going to review it? And she says, you have to do it. Stephen Frears takes on unsympathetic and, let's face it, a boring character, Queen Elizabeth II, the current queen, played by Helen Mirren. This goes back to the time of Princess Diana, her death, and how the queen dealt with or didn't deal with that death in a public way. And Tony Blair becomes a real character in this. And she says that Queen Elizabeth here is an unsympathetic character and, let's face it, a boring character. And Frears highlights a time in her life when she's utterly and completely eclipsed by Princess Diana's popularity, and he makes her fascinating and morally complex. It's a testimony to the importance of structure and storytelling. And she says that it's interesting to juxtapose the queen with Flags because, unlike the queen, Flags has at its core a truly amazing story with obvious philosophic undertones, but mishandles the structure of the story, as we said, and therefore renders this fascinating piece of history into a tedious two-hour bore. I don't think we would go
quite that far,
but do you agree with some or all of Christina's assessment that this is really fantastic storytelling? And really, one other thing she says is that Frears is able to build suspense and tension in a film when it's really just a story about something we all saw played out.
Yeah, back in 1997, summer of 1997. I have to admit that this is sort of an uncanny pairing because I had sort of an uncannily similar response to both films. Both have, honestly, very interesting subject matter, you know, in terms of what is the story. And again, here you have with summer of 19, not only is Queen Elizabeth II's persona, you know, being overwhelmed by the grief that people were responding to Princess Diana's death. But you also have Tony Blair coming in May of 1997, inaugurated in 1997 as this modernizer, Labour Party modernizer, after near 20 years, I think, of conservative rule, the Margaret Thatcher Party. And it's interesting what his role is as this modernizer, you know, he insists on being called Tony around the office.
Right.
Is that he actually has to restore people's faith in the monarchy.
True.
Fascinating concept.
Yes.
In terms of the role he plays as an ambassador between the two groups, the monarchy and his public office. But I never was really truly compelled by the story. Part of me is like, I've never been all that sympathetic or interested in the monarchy as
just a
cultural iconic thing.
Yeah.
You know, and so the story itself never quite took on the power or any more power than here's an old lady that kind of needs to turn around emotionally. You know, she came of age during a completely different time, and she's got this idea of what her role is going to be, and here's this young guy who needs to change her persona.
Okay.
There is something interesting in that, but I never felt really drawn in again emotionally by the story.
Huh. Well, I am more on Christina's side. I definitely like this movie better, a lot better than Flags of Our Fathers, and I think she's right. I think that Frears, and especially his star, the great Helen Mirren, make Elizabeth, a character I'm with you. I don't really think about the queen much, or I don't really care much about her story, but he really and she really turns her into, I think, an interesting conundrum. And you wonder how this family, the monarchy, can continually screw up as bad as they do. There's a line in there where Tony Blair even says, can someone save them from themselves? And yet there is a grace and something respectable, I think, about the code they follow, which Tony Blair does highlight, maybe even at times goes too far highlighting, or I think Frears does in the screenwriter, because at times it feels overwritten. They say things that we can already, you know, infer for ourselves. But anyway, that's one trifle I had with the film. But I think it's an interesting story about change and a character recognizing, as you said, that the world has kind of passed them by and that they have to adapt. And it gets a great timely jab, the most exciting part of the film for me, not because of really its political ramifications, but just because it all of a sudden made this whole story relevant today, is when the Queen says to Tony Blair, you were looking out for me because you know that this is all going to be gone for you someday.
They'll turn against you fast.
And we're sitting there watching and going, oh,
wow,
God.
Yes, it will.
Wow, they will. Exactly.
And the look on his face almost reflects that notion.
Exactly.
He actually says that, yes, that
it's going to happen.
It's a really interesting scene.
I like that. I think the movie, like I said, a little overwritten at times. I think it goes too far at one point with this visual metaphor of the buck. and how this buck that her family, that Elizabeth's family is hunting, how it relates to her. I think it goes too far, but I think it's funny, and I do think it's an interesting tie and maybe a double feature with Flags of Our Fathers, because it's another movie about fame and the media and this different generation. I mean, John Bradley in Flags of Our Fathers, the Ryan Phillippe character, he maybe isn't quite as fascinating as Queen Elizabeth in his stoicism, but they're very similar. They're old-fashioned kind of stoicism, but that's because we're comparing Ryan Phillippe to Helen Mirren, which right. isn't a fair comparison. So The Queen, for me, a film I did actually really like and really recommend people see.
I will say, I don't want to end here on another negative note here, but I will say Helen Mirren, an incredible actress, I will say, but I've always thought about her performances. There's a precision to them,
mm-hmm.
and that is an absolute compliment. I mean, she's wonderful. I think of Gosford Park, her performance, any number of wonderful performances, but there's a kind of cold precision there that I don't find ultimately all that involving.
Huh.
And I will say, I mean, I imagine somebody like Meryl Streep in the role. We saw her earlier in the year in The Devil Wears Prada in almost a similar role, not a similar role to Queen Elizabeth, but somebody who is emotionally removed, repressed in some way.
Very powerful.
How surprising Meryl Streep's performances are every time you see mm-hmm. her. Mirren's performance, precise, wonderful, articulate, but never emotionally alive and surprising, I think.
See where you're coming from, and yet I do disagree. I feel like there are moments
of surprise. I hear what you're saying, but I completely disagree.
No, I think there are moments of surprise and nuance and real spontaneity in her performance actually here. So,
all right. Well, if you've seen The Queen or Flags of Our Fathers and agree or disagree with our takes, or if you have any other thoughts you'd like to share, please email us at feedback@filmspotting.net or give us a call at 206-203-2463 and leave a voice message.
When we come back, our discussion shifts from one queen to another as we discuss John Cameron Mitchell's sexually explicit new film, Short Bus. And later in the show, we'll talk to Barry Pepper about working with Clint Eastwood on Flags of Our Fathers. Stay with us.
Where did it all begin? Well, I don't really care. There's plenty of faces along the way who'd be glad to place me there. Was it your fault or just my fault? Well, it don't matter anymore. You carve out names on window panes and leave them scattered on the floor. If the
Welcome back to Film Spotting here on Chicago Public Radio with Sam Van Halgren. I'm Adam Kempinar, and Sam, let's take a quick moment to thank Alejandro Escovedo and Bloodshot Records for today's music.
Chicago's own Bloodshot Records, that's from his 2001 release, A Man Under the Influence. Great, great music.
Yeah, I love Alejandro Escovedo. Let's also take a quick look at some of the new movies out on DVD this week. Cinema Paradiso, Gary Cooper, The Signature Collection, The Marlon Brando Collection, The West Wing Complete Series Collection, and a documentary you saw from this year, Wordplay.
Yeah, about the sort of culture of the crossword puzzle enthusiast, starring Will Shortz, the editor of the New York Times Crossword Puzzle. I think if you are among those people, among those crossword enthusiasts, you'll find something to like. The film itself doesn't really revolutionize the documentary genre so much, but there's some really interesting characters in there. Will Shortz himself is a very likable central presence, so it's fun.
And I guess probably the big release this week, the one that most families will be running out to buy, Pixar's latest animated feature, Cars, with Owen Wilson and Paul Newman.
Sign up for a free PeerFlix account at peerflix.com/filmspotting by 6 p.m. Pacific time on Friday, November 10th, and you'll be entered to win Cars, which includes deleted scenes and the Oscar-nominated short One Man Band. Last week's PeerFlix DVD winner of It's a Wonderful Life, the 60th anniversary edition, is Jose Aguilar from Laredo, Texas. Congratulations, Jose. Look for your copy of It's a Wonderful Life soon, courtesy of PeerFlix.
Hi, I'm John Cameron Mitchell, and you might know me from a film that I made called Hedwig and the Angry Inch. You might have also heard a little bit about my new film, Short Bus. It's everything you need to get through the next 2 years of George Bush.
That's the writer-director of Short Bus, John Cameron Mitchell, warning, preparing audiences for what they are about to see in Short Bus from the trailer.
Mm-hmm.
And the first thing you'll likely hear about John Cameron Mitchell's Short Bus is that it contains scenes of people having real sex. And it's true, it does. In fact, it has quite a few scenes of people having real sex. In fact, the working title of Mitchell's film was the Sex Film Project. Short Bus refers to the New York City sex salon hosted by real-life drag queen Justin Bond, where the characters meet every week. They're not just there to have sex, and just what they're doing there might be a good way to answer the question, just what is Short Bus all about? And Adam, John Cameron Mitchell isn't here to answer that question, unfortunately, so I'm going to ask you, what's Short Bus all about, and what did you think of it?
I can't believe you're posing this question to me. I mean, I have no idea what this film was about. It's about a lot of
things.
It's
so simple.
Of course. Yeah. Sure, it's about a sex therapist who can't have an orgasm.
There
That's ultimately what the film is about.
Go see it.
End of discussion. It's about characters, of course, the age-old dilemma of trying to connect and people trying to connect with each other in literal ways, obviously, and also figurative ways, more philosophical ways, in this kind of post-9/11 malaise, in this Bush era that he talks about there in that warning that we played there in the clip. It's about a lot of things and a lot of interesting things, and it's funny because I remember watching Ebert and Roper when they reviewed this movie, and I just wanted to get to the end and see, did they actually give it thumbs up? And it was Roper, and it was a guest, and I can't remember who the guest was. It was a female critic, I think maybe from TV Guide. And Roper liked the film and said, you know, everyone's going to talk about the sex in this film, but there are interesting characters and an interesting story, and he gave it thumbs up. And then it goes to her, and she's like, what are you talking about? You know, what characters are you talking about? What story are you talking about? This is just a porn film. This is just an excuse to make a porn movie. And I was watching it thinking, well, you know, she might be right. It's possible Roper is just trying to give this movie credit it doesn't deserve.
So at that point you hadn't seen the film?
I hadn't seen the film yet. I was listening to this, just their end discussion, and I thought, you know what, he could be wrong. Maybe she's right. Maybe this really is kind of like a porn film where it's just scenes that are built, characters that are there only for the purpose of getting them...
The payoff
of getting them into bed with each other. And, you know, a lot of graphic sex. And then I saw the film and realized that she's really dead wrong, I think. And Roper actually was right. There are interesting characters here. There are interesting characters going through, I think, interesting, believable, real problems. Though, admittedly, they're not the kind of problems that the characters that we discussed in Flags of Our Fathers could ever understand. People from that generation would probably freak out at the thought of these people having so many issues.
Not to generalize, but
well,
yes.
Yeah, I mean, suicidal about things that, you know, compared to people who lived through the Depression, whereas here we have people who can't feel anything. You know, it's very much a story for the aughts, you know, the generation that we're in. So, you know, but with that said, I felt for all of these characters. And the sex scenes, while some of them are uncomfortable at times and perhaps excessive, there really are only a handful of them that are really that way and I think could be called challenging to watch. And what's interesting, I think, is that Mitchell has made this film that's very graphic and sexual and has really, I think, removed any of the eroticism or titillation from those scenes. These are disillusioned characters who I think are almost just going through the motions. You get that sense that these sex scenes are really because it sex feels good. They know they should be doing it. It's a release. It's something they are doing to try to have an answer in their
life.
Like I said,
it gives them that opportunity to connect in a way,
sure,
even if they aren't able to emotionally.
Sure, but it never really is the answer, and right. Mitchell makes that clear. And so these sex scenes almost feel more rote than they do spontaneous, which you expect from, you know, passionate sex scenes. So I really was impressed with Short Bus and really impressed with Mitchell's audacity coming off Hedwig and the Angry Inch, which is another interesting, challenging, arty film that I really like, but this is a whole new level.
Yeah, I agree. And so I know you're saying you were impressed with it, but you
yes,
really liked it.
I did really like it.
I did too. I, in fact, loved the movie. It was the most, and last week we were discussing Marie Antoinette, and I described using the sort of esoteric word, I was like, well, it's the most patient movie I've seen all year, and that's a huge compliment. I loved that about Marie Antoinette. This film was the most alive movie mm-hmm. of the year. Every character is alive, and I was invested in every character, and I was thinking particularly, you sort of raised it, the character of Jamie, mm-hmm. a depressed character. He's depressed because he can't connect with anybody, with his boyfriend who loves him, and he loves his boyfriend, but they just can't, he can't connect. I love the way he describes depression. Mm-hmm. He can feel love coming to him, but it never gets beneath the skin.
Yeah.
It doesn't permeate. I mean, I think there's a pitfall, and I've seen it a number of times in terms of the depiction of depression. This film gets depression right. And that's just one thing. It's realistic, it's sensitive, and I think that's a good way. The way he treats that character and that character's dilemma of depression is the way he treats the film, the way he treats every character in the film, and the way he treats the country.
Mm-hmm.
What he's thinking in terms of what he feels in terms of what the country is undergoing post 9/11, specifically what New York is undergoing post 9/11, and whatever it's whatever he's trying to get at, whether it's sex, depression, personal disillusionment, New York City post 9/11, it's that same tone of sensitivity, humor, humanity. It's never cynical.
No.
This movie takes these wild flights of fancy that always feel like a completely organic part of the film he's making. And I saw this with a huge crowd at a film festival in Milwaukee earlier. And I haven't been in a film all year where people were as engaged and laughing, and it's just a joyous film. And I think one of the most patriotic films maybe ever made, certainly post 9/11, where we need this reminder of who we are as Americans and what we can celebrate, our freedoms.
Yeah.
And he does talk about the permeability, specifically of New York City, which is a really weighted word.
It is. It's,
of course. But he's talking just, I think, about the way, you know, at our best, we're open to change and exploring. I think he gets so many things right.
Yeah, no, I think there is a huge portion of our country that would disagree with you violently about what you said about this film being patriotic, but I am with you. And I think, you know, again, what's interesting is that the scenes in this film that will really shock people, they work because Mitchell has made an overtly political film that doesn't necessarily feel that way, but just the act of showing some of these characters doing what they are doing on screen is a political statement. And I love that rebellion. I love that audacity of it. And I think that what's amazing is he has that political aspect to it and just this in-your-face. I mean, we can't on public radio get into the opening scene of this film, but it really is just saying, here's what this movie is, and be ready for it. Brace yourself.
Yeah.
But then the tenderness he shows with these characters, and I hope you were more dutiful than I, and you wrote down the name of that actor who plays Jamie, because these are all non-stars in this film, but the actor who plays this character, Jamie,
P.J. Du Bois.
Yeah, who's kind of the core of the film in a way,
the
heart of it.
Core, yeah.
He's really brilliant,
yep,
and actually
absolutely.
Just about everybody in this scene is really, in this film, is really brilliant. But I give Mitchell so much credit for having that audacity and rebellious and in-your-face kind of attitude, and then the tenderness he shows for all these characters. I agree with you. There isn't any cynicism here. In fact, I think there is a lot of hope here, and I think really the essence of John Cameron Mitchell, if you've seen Hedwig and now Short Bus, is that he's able to take these really great actors, like I said, and get you to laugh at them really at the most uncomfortable times, and laugh with them, actually, is a better way to say it. And I know I'll never hear the Star Spangled Banner the same way again after watching this film.
That's true. That should be enough hopefully inspire people to go check this film out.
Yes.
That being said, it really is fair to warn people about the truly graphic nature of the sex that's depicted in this film, just in case that we glossed over that. Absolutely. The first couple scenes will prove that to you.
They will maybe shock you. And I think a film that we reviewed recently on our show, actually a while back during one of our marathons, Sam, on our podcast, I thought of Cabaret a lot with this film.
Sure.
Short Bus is sort of the new Cabaret. I think they're a nice pairing there. And
I love that.
Sex
and politics.
Exactly. Right. And this kind of denizen of debauchery, kind of isolated from the rest of the world, it's really interesting.
Well, if you've seen Short Bus and agree or disagree with our takes, send us an email at feedback@filmspotting.net.
After the break, another edition of Massacre Theater, and actor Barry Pepper explains how he ended up in another war movie. Back in a moment.
Don't love me too much. I don't think I can take it. Little tender to the touch. It feels like we can break it. I'll follow you. I'll follow you around. I'll follow you down. Don't you dance so close. Don't think I can follow. Been hanging with the ghosts. Because of all this trouble. But I'll follow you around. I'll follow you.
I don't like cellars. Let's just close it up. It's probably just some animal.
An animal?
An animal!
That is the stupidest thing I ever heard of.
Welcome back to Film Spotting on Chicago Public Radio with Adam Kempinar. I'm Sam Van Halgren. It's time for Massacre Theater, that time of the show where we absolutely butcher a beloved screenplay, a beloved film, and you get a shot at a DVD. Last week, Adam and I massacred the scene you just heard from Sam Raimi's horror classic, The Evil Dead, a tie-in with our top five scariest moments in honor of Halloween. Adam, reach into that film-spotting hat and pick out this week's winner.
And the winner is Clara Gelat from Washington, D.C. Congratulations, Clara. Email feedback@filmspotting.net, and we'll set you up with the DVD of your choice. And I also briefly want to congratulate Scott Jones from Provo, Utah. He was the previous week's winner of Massacre Theater. We mentioned him on our site, but didn't get a chance to mention his name on the air. Congratulations to Scott.
Betty.
Yeah, Betty. Look, you don't rush it. I don't rush it. Okay? Now, we're going to play this nice and close, just like in the movies, okay?
It's time for this week's edition of Massacre Theater, tying in with this week's top five sophomore efforts, second films from directors. We'll get into that more later in the next segment, but just keep that in mind as we do this scene. I don't know if this film was necessarily beloved, as you mentioned, Sam, at the top.
By some. Maybe regionally.
By us.
And by us, certainly.
By us, but I don't know if on a mass level, but we'll see. We'll see if listeners know what film we are massacring, and you kick it off, Sam, so I will give you the action. And action.
Check it out. My new Gore-Tex watch. I can store numbers. Tonight, I'll fill it. All or nothing. Tonight, I'll be the super me.
What if the super you meets the super her and the super her rejects you?
Then it's no problem.
Why?
Because it was never you. It was just an act. I live my life like a French movie.
What?
And scene.
If you know what film Sam and I just massacred, send us an email by Monday, November 13th, to feedback@filmspotting.net. The winner will be selected randomly from all the correct entries and announced on next Wednesday's Film Spotting podcast. To listen and to get official rules, visit filmspotting.net.
That's right. Adam, earlier this week, you had a chance to talk with actor Barry Pepper. Pepper is currently promoting Flags of Our Fathers, but of course, we've liked Pepper in a number of films, Spike Lee's 25th Hour, Spielberg's Saving Private Ryan, and as Roger Maris in Billy Crystal's 61. Maybe his best performance as far as I'm concerned. Really great film. Let's hear your conversation.
We're here on Film Spotting with actor Barry Pepper. His latest movie is Clint Eastwood's Flags of Our Fathers. Barry, thank you for your time. It's a real pleasure to have you on.
Thank you for having me.
This is your third war movie. You played an Army sniper in Saving Private Ryan and a reporter in the Vietnam film We Were Soldiers. What draws you to this material?
It is indeed just the material. The scripts are tremendous. They're entertaining and compelling, and you just can't imagine not being a part of them when you read them. So it really has very little to do about the war genre. The stories are just tremendous, and then of course you're working with these incredible filmmakers, Spielberg and Clint Eastwood, and this film, Flags of Our Fathers in particular, is based on actual events of the battle for Iwo Jima. So you're playing a real person, who lived and fought and died on that island, and so it comes with a far greater depth of responsibility than some of the other ones that are based loosely on accounts.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about that. You play Sergeant Mike Strank, the leader of the group who raised the flag. Did you do research? I'm assuming you did. How much research did you do about the real character?
Well, the book by James Bradley, who is the son of John Doc Bradley, one of the flag raisers, was a tremendous source material for all of us. There's great documentaries and other really good books on Iwo Jima, websites, and just a huge compilation of photographs and archival footage. And so, yeah, there's a mountain of research that you do in preparation, and then you speak with veterans. But when we arrived in Iceland, I think two or three days before principal photography began, there was just no time to prep at that point. You had to come completely prepared. He wanted no rehearsal, no boot camp. He wanted it to be fluid and organic and fast and chaotic, like it was for, these 18, 19-year-old kids that landed on the beaches of Iwo Jima.
Yeah, and speaking of that kind of chaos of it, I think people will find a lot of similarities, perhaps, between the Normandy sequence in Private Ryan and the storming of Iwo Jima here in Flags. And I'm curious how Spielberg directs a sequence like that versus Clint Eastwood as an actor. Were there any differences?
Well, they were very, very different engagements. When the Marines landed on Iwo Jima, they they didn't see any enemy soldiers. In fact, for the month or 36 days that they were on Iwo Jima, they rarely saw an alive Japanese soldier, because months before the D-Day on Iwo Jima in February of 45, the Japanese had built 16 miles of underground, like subterranean concrete reinforced tunnels and bunkers, and so they were completely hidden, and yet for the entire 36 days they always had the Marines in their sights from every vantage point on the island. So it was a very disconcerting and horribly atrocious place to be. And so it was a very different setting. The Marines landed on Iwo Jima, and the Japanese waited for about 2 or 3 hours before they opened fire. So the beaches were congested with tanks and men and gear and just, you know, piles of munitions. And because the volcanic sand was like, you know, running in a wheat bin, it was just, you know, 3 steps forward, 5 steps back, you know, tanks and everything were getting stuck. And then once the beaches were congested, that's when the Japanese opened up on the Marines. And so it was a very different staging. And so it was different than the way Spielberg approached it, for sure. I think Steven, you know, having done a boot camp and does a fair bit more rehearsal, spent a little bit more time on the scenes than we did with the way that Clint shot it. Clint didn't want anything staged, anything pre-rehearsed. He wanted it to be absolutely organic.
Well, that's interesting, because I was going to ask, I've always been curious about battle scenes like this on such a major level. Are they kind of done in a documentary-like fashion almost, where there's multiple cameras and you're essentially acting out, you're restaging the battle, or is it still kind of broken down into pieces?
It really depends on the sequence, but yeah, no, you're right. It's a lot of cameras just capturing as much fluidity and just, you know, the raw power of the moment. You know, you've got, he cast a lot of young kids,
mm-hmm.
like Joseph Cross and Jamie Bell. They were 19 years old when we were shooting in Iceland, and that's what, you know, that's the age of these boys, that these Marines that landed on Iwo. So he was very focused on just not putting anything on screen that wasn't authentic.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you have a character, there's a scene where Ira Hayes is beside another young soldier, and the young soldier is decapitated. And, I mean, it's a horrifically archaic moment, but that actually happened. And so nothing is salacious or just put in his films for, you know, gratuitous violence sake. You know, he only wanted to put there what actually happened. And so it was just wonderful to work with him, because he had those sensibilities. Being of a man of that generation, he was in his teens during Iwo Jima. He was in the military during the Korean War, and so he really has an intimate perspective on what took place then.
It's an interesting point about the age of these guys and those actors. You're right, Joseph Cross and Jamie
yeah.
Bell. I mean, they do come off as very young, and maybe even more so than other war movies I've seen. You really do get that sense of these guys being youths. I mean, it's
yeah.
unbelievable.
That's really what drew me to the character. I was offered a different character in the beginning, but when I'd read the script and the book, I was compelled to play the sergeant, Mike Strank, because he was just 24 years old. He was just a kid himself, you know. He was a seasoned veteran of other brutal campaigns in the Pacific, like Bougainville and in the Solomons, and so when he landed on Iwo Jima, he's leading these, you know, 18, 19 year old kids into battle, and yet he wasn't your prototypical Marine sergeant. He did, you know, chomping on a cigar and barking profanities,
right?
He really was just one of the kids, and they really had this tremendous familial bond of youth that kept them together, and I really liked the idea of putting something sort of unique on screen like that.
It's interesting too that these young guys really do look up to Mike and see him as a hero. Certainly Ira Hayes sees him as certainly a hero, and I'm wondering, as an actor, I mean, do you have to kind of just put that out of your mind and just play a normal guy?
Oh, yeah, you know, it's interesting, because everything you read about that character, that's what you read. All of the stories that you come across about Sergeant Mike Strank was just that, but that's kind of the essence of the film, in a sense. Those themes are, you know, what was in Clint Eastwood's primary focus. Like, how does a person deal with the label of hero, especially when they know they're being asked to play, you know, merely play a role in a sort of a necessary illusion. You know, it's not out, they're torn because it's not outright exploitation, because it was of great importance to rally and unify the country at that time and to support the war. But the film follows these three young survivors of the flag raising and how, you know, each man was left to deal with the effects it had on his life, being lionized and wined and dined and being called a hero when each of them knew that all their buddies were still back on Iwo Jima, still slogging it out, and thousands were dying every day. Japanese and U.S. Soldiers were, I think for those 36 days, there was like almost like 1,000 men dying a day.
Wow.
You know, it's just hard to imagine that those sort of casualties and statistics could just be a footnote in a history book, because I really didn't know much about this battle. But when you start to dig into it a little deeper, you're absolutely blown away with what took place there.
Yeah, I want to close out with a couple of questions about other films that you've been. I've really enjoyed your work in a number of movies, 61, The Three Burials, Melquiades Estrada, The 25th Hour, and The Green Mile. But when I mentioned this interview to a friend of mine, the first role he thought of was Private Jackson, the sniper in Saving Private Ryan. Is that the role you maybe get recognized the most for, or is it another one?
No, it's a fair bit for that role, but it's funny. You know, it's funny how film affects people differently and what each person takes away from it. And some of the films that I'm most proud of are the little ones that, you know, that most people haven't seen, films that I produced and they had very little money and we shot them in an incredibly short period of time. And they were just, you know, arduous shooting conditions, like a film I did in the Arctic called The Snow Walker. So it's nice when somebody comes up to you and says, "Hey, man, I really liked that movie, The Snow Walker." And, you know, only a handful of people saw it. But, yeah, it's interesting. You'd think that most people would say, "Hey, you were great in Saving Private Ryan." But when someone comes up and mentions an obscure film that you really were passionate about, it's nice to hear those, too.
Well, I mentioned The 25th Hour, and I have to ask you about one of my favorite scenes in that film is your first scene. The back and forth between you and Aaron Stanford just cracks me up, and I actually want to play a quick bit of it here.
Okay.
I don't like it, Frank. Claims numbers have dropped 3 weeks straight, and I don't feel comfortable with this.
What, so claim numbers drops, everybody thinks employment's going to be up? Come on,
everybody, son. Frank, look at me when I talk to you.
What?
Everybody's thinking this because it's pretty much always true. I mean, when it rains outside, people get wet. Right or wrong, Frank?
Not this time, Sal. I'm telling you, I got a theory. Look at this.
Check good. You've got a theory.
I want you to tell me about that scene. Was it all in the script, or was there some improvisation? And is it fun or challenging to play a character like Slattery, who, you know, has so much cockiness and bravado?
Yeah, it was a lot of fun. In fact, Spike brought me to New York about a month before rehearsals began, to shadow his personal investment banker, his personal stockbroker.
Huh.
And this guy was basically, he was Frank Slattery.
Really?
And so I just went with him everywhere he went. He was a very, very wealthy, very, you know, sort of an elite dude. And so you'd go, you know, you'd be front row Madison Square Gardens at the basketball games. You'd be at the best steakhouses and nightclubs and down in the stock market pits and you know, the electricity of his work day and just following him everywhere. You know, I just was his shadow for about a month. And so that's really where I found the character, was just working with him. It was a really cool approach to finding a character. I thought Spike was bang on with that. That was a neat experience.
Well, Barry Pepper, you can see him now in Clint Eastwood's Flags of Our Fathers. And again, Barry, thank you so much for your time. Really appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you.
We're going to take one more quick break. When we come back, 10 or 15 films that defy the phrase sophomore slump. Stay with us.
Out where the valley lies, out where the eagle flies, on your wedding day. Long as the river runs, long as the time to come, so I've got to say that you look so. You were locked in time by the ring that binds you. on your wedding day.
You're listening to Film Spotting on Chicago Public Radio, and Sam, this is really a unique show for us. We're here in Wausau, Wisconsin.
As we mentioned at the top and left unexplained until
yes,
now.
Yes, at the top of the show, we're actually in town here for a friend's wedding. A friend we've actually mentioned on our show before. We'll mention him again. Kevin Rich, getting married. The guy who introduced us. Without
right.
him,
That's
there'd
right.
be no Film Spotting.
And introduced me to my wife.
Exactly.
The man is a god.
He
really.
Is a god. Yeah. And so we're here to celebrate his wedding. And we thought, hey, what way to honor him better than to do a show right here from his wedding? I'm sure he really appreciates it. But it is an interesting show as well because we usually have a lot of listener feedback in our show. We have great listener feedback from some of our recent reviews and top fives, including Top 5 Scary Moments, Thoughts on the Prestige, and Marie Antoinette. And again, we appreciate everyone who sent those in. Keep them coming. We'll get to that feedback on our next podcast. Another thing that makes this show interesting is that we have a guest for our top five. And people who go way back with our show, people who go back to episode number 64 of our podcast will remember.
That's a classic.
It is a classic.
That one gold, didn't it?
I think it's in the Podcasting Hall of Fame,
that's
actually.
Right.
And it is all because of the fact that we had a guest, Maddie Ballgame, our friend. Maddie, thanks for stopping by.
Hey, great to be here.
We have to mention that we actually did have several listeners write in after Ballgame appeared on our show and said, you know what, we need more Maddie Ballgame, including recently a listener, great email, Greg Nemec wrote in. He had just recently discovered our show, went back and listened to the previous 129 episodes of our podcast.
Over the course of about 14 days.
Yeah, something like that, just ridiculous.
We're in his dreams.
I know, and he said, he wrote some notes to us and said, you know what, more Maddie Ballgame. And we said, you know what, Greg, you asked for it. You got it. So, Maddie, thanks for stopping by.
Well, we'll go about changing that real quick.
Okay. Well, Maddie Ballgame, we are getting into our top five sophomore efforts. I don't know how much of a fun list this was for you to put together. It was kind of difficult because you think of great films, and then you have to go check whether or not it was actually their second film mm-hmm. or not. But, Sam, why don't you go ahead and set up your list and do your number five?
Yeah, generally, I mean, I originally proposed, doesn't a true second film require some expectation on the part of the audience? And, you know, for example, we talked about, you know, what's the true second film of somebody like P.T. Anderson? Not many people have seen Hard Eight, for example. Mm. A lot of people saw Boogie Nights, and I thought of, isn't a second film maybe more like Magnolia, when
maybe.
All eyes were watching?
Or the Coen brothers, maybe.
Or, you know, and they'd scored a big, you know, they got a ton of money from the studio, they had real artistic freedom.
Mm-hmm.
And you can't think of P.T. Anderson's Magnolia without thinking of artistic freedom
sure.
in some way. That being said, I went with your criteria, literally, their second film, and you added this notion that the second film actually has to be their best film in the entire canon. I think actually my top five actually fits that, I think. Maybe
okay.
except for my number one. We'll just have to wait for that. But my number five is a film we just talked about, John Cameron Mitchell's Short Bus.
Wow.
We like his debut film, Hedwig and the Angry Inch, a lot. And it was a very personal film. Hedwig was this character that John Cameron Mitchell had invented for the stage for a cabaret, Lower East Side of Manhattan cabaret, and something he had created over years and years and years. And so there was some sense of like, okay, he's brought this personal character to life. Great film. But what was his second film going to be like? How much of a filmmaker is John Cameron Mitchell? And added to which, all we knew about his second film was that it was going to depict graphic, real sex. So there was a lot of expectation here. And as we discussed mm-hmm. just moments ago, I couldn't have been more impressed. I can't wait to see what John Cameron Mitchell has next. His best film right now is his second film, Short Bus.
Well argued. Sam, Maddie Ballgame, chime in.
Well, I have to tell you, I mean, when you first presented me with this, immediately I went to those answers that would make me look really smart.
Mm-hmm. That's
you
what
know,
we
sort
do
of
every
definitive
week.
Films, exactly. But then I was like, that just sort of betrays the what makes these lists great, how personal and unique they are. And so I'm coming out, guns blazing. David S. Ward was the screenwriter for The Sting, would go on to co-write Sleepless in Seattle. His first feature film was an adaptation of John Steinbeck's Cannery Row with Nick Nolte and Deborah Winger, which by all accounts is a colossal failure. But he more than made up for it in 1989 by making what I think is the definitive sports movie of all time, and that's Major League. Now, and I know people are rolling their eyes thinking, oh, this is just a dumb sports comedy. It's not. It's actually a smart, dumb sports comedy. And if you appreciate
there are enough of those.
If you appreciate baseball at all, please go check it out. Because all of the humor is driven from the plot and from baseball.
And from character, yes.
And from character. And I don't think they make that enough anymore. It really is a great film.
I agree with you completely. I love Major League.
And having lived with Matty Ballgame, I can't say this is the first time I've heard, but Major League is the greatest sports film of all time.
Okay. Pulp Fiction,
maybe the great, maybe the great film, greatest film of all time.
Yeah. Maybe so. And we should say, you just mentioned Pulp Fiction. We're actually calling this the Pulp Fiction Memorial List.
That's right.
So it's not going to appear in our top five. Right. Well, he has the great Major League, the great populist choice, and I go back to pretentious film snob. I bring us back to that area with my number five, Days of Heaven from Terrence Malick, his follow-up to Badlands. And you know what? This might violate my own rule because I like all of Terrence Malick's films that he's made. I think it's only four of them, and I like them all, and I especially like Badlands, his first film with Sissy Spacek and Martin Sheen. I may even like it better than Days of Heaven, but the fact is, as a second film, this film is one of those paradigm movies in terms of how to shoot a film and just how to tell a story visually, and one of the most interesting films just to look at with Richard Gere in this movie. But great cinematography, of course, shot at the magic hour. Really beautiful, interesting, complex film that I like a lot. It's my number five.
And certainly the way it's narrated, too, a really original way. Mm-hmm. Yeah, beautiful film. Great choice and really pretentious. My number four is a film using my earlier criteria, the second film that has a lot of expectation. This director wouldn't have qualified because it is Wes Anderson. His second film, of course, is Rushmore. But his second film, using my earlier criteria, would have been The Royal Tenenbaums, a film that I think is wildly overrated.
Mm-hmm.
It wouldn't have made my list. I've said before, Bottle Rocket, Anderson's first film, is my favorite film. I love everything about it, even the flaws, primarily that being James Caan's out-of-control performance. Although Rushmore isn't my favorite Anderson movie, maybe, Bottle Rocket is, I do think it's his best. It's certainly tighter, it's more complicated emotionally, and it really introduces, even more than Bottle Rocket, that Anderson style, the quirky sincerity, and really introduced him as this truly original filmmaker.
Great choice. I love Wes Anderson as well. Matty Ballgame, your number four.
My number four, pretty obvious one. The Coen Brothers, Raising Arizona. Still cracks me up, along with Some Like It Hot. I think it's one of the funniest movies ever captured on film. Nick Cage just gives an unbelievable performance.
He does. Really one that I strongly considered for my list. My number four, I'm still in this pretentious film snob realm, I guess, but it is a movie that listeners of our podcast know that I love, and it has to be on here for me. It's Hal Hartley's film Trust, and it's his follow-up to the movie The Unbelievable Truth. And I told you, I just recently watched the film Amateur, which is a really celebrated Hal Hartley film, and you even
film
had it on
I
a
love.
Recent
yeah. Yeah.
top five, and I watched it and was just basically bored to tears by it. It did nothing for me, even with Martin Donovan in it, who's also in Trust. But with that in mind, it made me just remember again why I love Trust so much. And it's really because just there's an energy about it, the way it just crackles with life, really, and the way Amateur doesn't in some ways. It's so deadpan that it just kind of lays there for me. But Trust is a film I love, and his second film, so my number four.
Hal Hartley's highly anticipated second film, Trust.
That's right.
All right. My number three is Mike Nichols, The Graduate. His first film, Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, of course, the adaptation of the Edward Albee play, nominated for 13 Oscars, won 5. His second film, a year later, manages to be even better, although it was only nominated for 7 Oscars and did win him the Best Director Oscar. It's like he's working in two different mediums with the two films. I mean, the first, of course, Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, a black and white adaptation of a stage play. The Graduate, the way he tells that story cinematically, it's two different directors, it's two different pictures. And it certainly, I think, even looking at his long, long career, I still think it's his best film, mm-hmm. The Graduate, 1968. Great, great performances, and the way the film is told is incredible. And I was thinking of a film we disagree on, Closer, a more recent Nichols film.
A great film.
How unlikable, I said, those characters are, how unsympathetic, doing nasty things to each other.
Sure.
Look at the first two films in his canon.
Yeah.
The same thing.
It is.
Really, unsympathetic characters doing unlikable things to each other.
He's fascinated by that, clearly. Yes, okay. Ball game, your number three.
My number three is Warren Beatty's second film, Reds. Absolutely unbelievable. This movie would not be made today. I mean, they're making epics, but they're Titanic and they're gladiators. This is an epic in the mold of Dr. Zhivago about ideas and philosophy and passion. And there's just so much passion on that screen. I don't think you'll see it again anytime soon.
Well, Sam, the reaction
I'm
on
embarrassed.
Your face.
I can't believe it. My jaw dropped.
Yeah, as
I just
said,
saw
Reds.
This film.
Yeah.
I couldn't believe this film. Absolutely. What do I have to knock out? What's gone off the list now?
Can
do we have to lose? Do we have to lose John Cameron Mitchell? I hate
maybe,
to.
Maybe. You might have to read
Matty Ballgame shames me.
He shames me. He's shaming us all because I'm still being pretentious, my number three, and I'm actually kind of being wishy-washy here a little bit because it's come up before. I had this film, Drugstore Cowboy, Gus Van Sant, on my list of directorial debuts. And as I announced a while back on our show, I actually realized that most people say Mala Noche, even though it's only 78 minutes long, is really Van Sant's first feature. But playing with that idea again of kind of expectations, no one really saw Mala Noche. But whether you say Van Sant's second film is Drugstore Cowboy or My Own Private Idaho, I love both films. And both have come up on several top five lists. Really, I don't have anything interesting to say about them. I just think they're brilliant films. And in fact, I want to play here quickly a clip from Drugstore Cowboy.
The reason nobody mentioned dogs, Rick, is because just to have mentioned a dog would have been a hex in itself.
All right, well, now that we're on the subject, are there any other sacred things we're not supposed to mention that are going to affect our future?
Yeah, as a matter of fact, there are. And we might as well discuss them right now, being as we're shut down for the next 30 days. Hats. Okay, hats. If I ever see a hat on a bed in this house, man, like, you'll never see me again.
That's my number three, and we're at number two.
We're at number two. I'm going to see your clip, and I'm going to raise you a clip here.
Why the ghost store him?
Well, the sucker's rare. You know? Mm-hmm. I'm the only one in the world who knows how to cultivate it. See, the idea was get the Indians to pull it from the swamp. As I researched it, as long as I don't touch the plant, Florida can't touch us. Mm-hmm. And I stopped future poaching by making the flowers readily available in stores. I'm a hero. Flowers are saved. La Roche and nature win.
That's Meryl Streep and Chris Cooper in Spike Jonze's adaptation. Jonze's debut film being John Malkovich, one of those great movie-going experiences for me. I'd never seen anything like it, the writing, the visual style, the deadpan oddness of it. And I couldn't wait to see what Spike Jonze, but really also Charlie Kaufman, the screenwriter, had next. And I think adaptation is a better, more sophisticated film in the same way that Wes Anderson made a maybe more sophisticated, more emotionally mature film with Rushmore after Bottle Rocket. I think what you see here with Spike Jonze doing an adaptation is sort of equal to that. You know, he's using some of the same components that he's learned visually, but also incorporates, I think, and makes a really moving emotional film.
Okay, ball game. Your number two.
Oh, my number two is actually from one of my most underrated but beloved directors, and that's Penny Marshall. Her second film, 1988, was Big, and I think it's just a great film. She did Jumpin' Jack Flash in 1986, and then followed up with this one. Tom Hanks's performance in that will go down for the ages.
And I love the fact that we have Maddie Ballgame here to remind us that comedies are good, because apparently we love to skip them.
Rushmore.
You're right, but it's just
you're the
me.
Only one.
I'm the
bringing us down.
One.
You're right.
I am. Way too serious, and it's going to get even more depressing here with my number two, which is David Lynch's The Elephant Man, a film that I adore, even though it haunts me and disturbs me to no end. And it was his follow-up to Eraserhead, a really out there, also disturbing movie, but in a completely different way. And The Elephant Man, again, Anthony Hopkins is great in this. It's come up on the show before, nominated for Best Picture in 1980. And it is, as I mentioned, just a film that I can picture scenes in my head constantly, the black and white cinematography of it, and the scenes that really bother me from it have never left me from even seeing it as a kid. It's my number two.
It's a good choice. I'm impressed, really, so far. There's been no overlap.
True.
Yeah.
Great work, everyone. My number one, here we go, more Charlie Kaufman. I've got Michel Gondry's Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, his second film. And his first film was also a Kaufman-penned script, Human Nature. And as odd as Being John Malkovich, adaptation, and Eternal Sunshine are, Human Nature, if you haven't seen it, is kind of like watching Charlie Kaufman on LSD. It's just too much. There's an oversaturation of oddity. And with Eternal Sunshine, it shows, again, that sense of going, like Anderson, you know, like Spike Jonze, adding this level of emotional maturity and sophistication into this story, into these really odd stories, the way they're structured, the way the stories are told. But I think Kaufman, I've said it before, just writes some of the most exciting stuff. And he's been paired, luckily, with two, I think, of the most imaginative and creative directors working today. And I will say, you know, this is the exception to the list. You know, is this their greatest film? Michel Gondry, I think, has now made a greater film. Science of Sleep, we were just talking
about
it.
That's right, a film you loved.
A couple weeks ago, I absolutely loved it.
Okay, well, Maddie Ballgame, are you going to continue in this thread of keeping us laughing, or are you going to get serious on us?
I'm going to get serious. Well, number one, and it's another obvious choice, because I'm not counting Amblin, and I'm not counting Duel, which was a made-for-TV movie.
You're going Spielberg.
I'm going Spielberg. I'm going with Jaws. Not only that it reinvented cinema in the 70s and opened the door for so many filmmakers, but also because I just think it's a terrific film, and it surprises me how many people I meet that still have not seen Jaws, mm-hmm. because they think it's the Shark Attack movie.
Yeah.
And yeah, the last 5 minutes are kind of silly, but before that, all the way up to it, I think it's one of the greatest pictures ever made.
A great choice, a movie that doesn't get enough love probably on Film
totally
Spotting,
agree.
So thank you for that. My number one is a film you actually used as your example, kind of setting up this top five. I'm going with Boogie Nights, Paul Thomas Anderson. I love Heart 8. I recently had Heart 8 or Sydney actually in a top five. What was that? Movies About Starting Over was our top five topic then. But Boogie Nights, for me, quite simply, one of the most quotable movies of all time. And again, like a lot of these directors, we saw it with Cameron Mitchell, you mentioned, and Wes Anderson, you're right, kind of just going to a greater level of sophistication. I love the fact that Sydney is much more small, you know, a smaller, intimate showcase. And then you got Boogie Nights, this kind of grand, epic tale in a way that covers, you know, 20-some years in this life of this porn star. But really, for me, it's because of the fact that, like, I can endlessly quote from this movie and love it. And I love P.T. Anderson. I do love all of his films, but I think probably Boogie Nights still, for me, is my favorite P.T. Anderson movie. So
Adam Kipnar, porn stars, street hustlers,
yep.
pretension.
That's what I love. That's
I love
me
it.
In
I
a
love
nutshell.
It.
Well, again, Matty Ballgame, we can't thank you enough for stopping by.
Hey, not a problem. What? No American Graffiti anywhere?
No, I know.
And you
I
guys
know.
Call yourselves
I know.
Film
You're
reviewers?
The populist. We were waiting for you.
Right. It's been great, guys. Thanks.
You know, a couple others I should throw out there just to cover our bases. Seven, David Fincher's
sure.
film.
Lost
Memento.
In Translation.
Memento, right. Christopher Nolan. Platoon was Oliver Stone's second film.
Oh,
and probably
wow.
still his best film. But anyway, that is our top five, and that is our show.
Opening in wide release this weekend, Ridley Scott's A Good Year with Russell Crowe, Will Ferrell in Stranger Than Fiction, Harsh Times with our friend Christian Bale. Anytime we get to see Christian Bale.
Sure.
The Return, a supernatural thriller with Sarah Michelle Gellar, and we'll have our review of Borat, plus a review of Stranger Than Fiction, and our top five Strangers in a Strange Land culture clash movies.
That's what we think we're going with, tying right. in with Borat. And we should briefly say the reason we're not reviewing it right now, even though it just opened, because we're in Wausau, Wisconsin.
That's right.
And it's not playing here.
It's only playing on 800 screens
yeah.
to make it to Northern
Maybe
Wisconsin.
Isn't a big shock. Well, please send any feedback about the show to feedback@filmspotting.net or give us a call 206-203-2463 and leave a message. Check out our Top 5 Archive, a calendar of upcoming reviews and more at filmspotting.net. And please help us reach new listeners by voting for us at podcastalley.com. A direct link is available on our blog under Vote for Film Spotting. Also on our blog, sign up for The Dope Sheet, the Film Spotting weekly email blast.
Thanks to Alejandro Escovedo and Bloodshot Records for today's music. For more information, check them out on the web at bloodshotrecords.com. And thanks to our guests, Barry Pepper and Mr. Matty Ballgame. For Film Spotting, I'm Sam Van Halgren.
And I'm Adam Kempinar. Thanks for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.
Film Spotting is presented by PeerFlix. Swap your unwanted DVDs for the ones you really want at peerflix.com/filmspotting. You're listening to Film Spotting on Chicago Public Radio, and Sam, this really is a unique foreshow. A foreshow us? You ready?
Yes. I'm ready. Are you?
Fuck off.